Philip Shepherd now joins. Welcome, Philip.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Philip.
Have you received it, Nelson?
Yes, I did. Is my username my email address or just my name?
You just your name.
Just the name?
Mm-hmm.
My conference is currently unavailable at this time.
Oh. And the number is 7430930.
7430930.
Oh, sorry. 7430930. Is that better?
Well, username should be Milton Mueller.
That's right.
And conference number.
Excuse me, Ms. Rotolo now joins.
Should be. Type it in.
7430930.
I have 7403.
7430930930.
Excuse me, Mr. Talis now joins.
Hey, baby, sorry.
Okay, I got it.
Okay, then you see who's on.
Right. So, shall we get started?
Will you ask the operator, or shall I do the star zero for you?
I can do the star zero.
Okay.
Okay, the conference is being recorded. We have about here. Do we need to go through the roll call for people who can't see this list?
Excuse me, Mr. Eisenberg now joins.
Okay. Okay, we're getting some quick additions here. We have Palmer Hamilton, right?
Right.
Patrick.
Susan Kalaguchi now joins.
Patrick, are you here from the registry constituents?
Pat from the APWG is here.
Boston Raptors, Opsa is here.
We have Carol Bird. We have Eric Durker. We have Dan Krim. Maria Farrell is on from ICANN staff. Margie from the registrar constituency. Philip from business constituency. Melissa Rotolo. Melanie Holloway. David Ferris. Steve Metalitz. Doug Eisenberg. Michael Warnicki. And John Levine. Susan Kawajuchi and Woot Dinatris. All right. So you've all received the reports that I sent out. I'm trying to push forward. We basically, I think, supposed to have one more meeting. We could probably call for two by telephone. And it's, you know, pretty apparent at this stage where the areas of diversity are. And I don't see a lot of convergence, so I suggested four propositions. And two of those were a call for basically straw polls, which should probably best be conducted by email, but we can discuss our opinions about what positions to take on this call.
Milton, could I ask a procedural question on the straw poll? Are you talking about by constituency, or are you talking about a head count?
Please identify yourself when you speak.
Shirley, this is Palmer Hamilton.
I was talking more about a sense of how the constituencies are arrayed on that issue. Definitely not a head count. We're not supposed to be voting on this, but I want to know pretty much where the different parties stand on those two issues.
Not a formal vote, but still by constituency. A vote, but not in terms of being a formal vote. Is that...
Yeah, not even a formal vote in the sense that we're counting numbers. It's more if basically we discover nobody disagrees with something, it would be easy to go forward. If we discover that people are all over the map, then we pretty much know where we stand.
Milton, this is Steve Metallic. I get in the queue when you establish one.
Okay. So anyway, we have those four propositions, and I would propose as our agenda today that we simply go down the list of those propositions and discuss them and decide what we want to do on them.
Milton, it's Maria for the queue as well, please.
All right. Do you have a procedural point about my suggestion?
I do, yes.
Okay, why don't you go first then?
Okay, sure. Briefly, it's just to remind people that within this entire working group, we really have tried to steer away from polling and voting because we've been so divisive in the past. And if we are trying to measure support and agreement, I mean, I can give people a rundown of exactly what we mean by those terms again. And I personally would defer to Philip as well on this, but I really think we should try to avoid mechanisms that have the potential to be divisive within the group.
Well, that's definitely true, and that's why I'm not calling it a vote, but if I don't know where people actually come out on a particular issue, I'm not sure how we can move forward.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the other point really was also that we've tried to make this group very much open to observers to be full participants in the group, and moving back to constituency voting just doesn't seem to be especially open to the new people we have involved and the fact that we're really trying to take a fresh look at these issues.
Right. Again, I'm not calling for a vote, but if there happen to be eight people from the non-commercial side of the fence on the call, that's precisely what I mean by paying more attention to how the vote is distributed among various stakeholder groups than to the actual numbers.
Well, can I make a suggestion then? What if you were to look at the various options and ask, is there agreement, i.e. is the group relatively unanimous or almost unanimous in its support for something? Is there just simply support, so there's a gathering of opinion behind it, but there are some dissenting voices? Or is it simply a question where what we call alternative view, where there are many differing opinions and really no gathering of agreement? What I'm really pushing at is, given that we're trying to move away from constituency, from voting, we can call it polling or straw polling or whatever we like, but it really is what it is. And is there another way we can get at measuring support without going down the road of voting and also of excluding people in the group?
Right. That's exactly what I want to do. Let's take, for example, the structural approach for banks. I just want to know who supports them. And I don't want to make it a head count, and I don't want to make it a constituency GNSO type vote. I just want to know who supports that. So can we call it an expression of support instead of a straw poll? Will that make people happier?
Milton, Philip here, perhaps just to help. I said the way we had set up the subgroups was as you're aware, really to discuss and list options, and indeed ideally group options that are similar, so that we have a manageable set of things and to look at as a group as a whole. And that was based on the fact that although we had three questions, there was overlap in all of those, so that at some point needs to go to the wider group for this sort of exercise. So I think it's clearly informative, I think, for the subgroup to, in the way that it lists its options in the sort of final report or whatever of the subgroup, for perhaps indications there saying, you know, sort of nobody disagreed with this, but with option one, you know, there was mixed feeling about option two or something like that. I mean, that sort of feeling would be fine, and I don't think you need to be any more definitive than that at this point, because we'll be taking as best we can, gauging support in the bigger group subsequently based on the output that you're producing.
Well, I understand that, but I think that we're simply, there's no way to avoid at some point asking people whether there's support for something or not.
Hmm.
And we can save the larger group, which is going to need all the help it can get, a lot of time by finding out things where there is substantial agreement and things where there is that can be taken pretty much off the table, or at least identified as things that have a very limited amount of support.
Bill, Ms. Russ here, so if I can jump into the queue on this question.
All right. Steve, you were in the queue. Did you address the same question?
Yeah, I'll pass. Most of what I was going to say was raised by Maria and Philip.
All right. So go ahead, Ron.
So I joined this call late as well, so I only caught the last half of the discussion. If I understand it right, it leads me to a question from Maria, which is, in participating in the last call, I noticed that that John has somehow captured feelings of those participating in that last subgroup. And how did he go about measuring that, Maria?
He pretty much, a number of ways, but mostly he really asked if there was support, and then he himself made an assertion as to whether there was support for something or agreement on it, and circulated it in a draft, and people were then free to raise, you know, their objections to that, which in fact I did on one of the cases, and there seemed to be pretty happy, you know, pretty satisfied people that it did reflect what the group thought.
Well, then that's what we're going to do here. I'm going to eliminate the word straw poll, and I'm going to ask how much support there is for the word the various things. But on two of the propositions I suggested, the ones where I suggested a straw poll, I really have no idea, based on our discussions, whether there is any preponderance of opinion in any particular direction. So what I'll propose is that we discuss those propositions, not that we hold straw polls. We'll have a discussion, and we'll determine through that how much support there is, and I'll draft a report which people can say whether it expresses their feeling as to how much support is out there or not. Okay?
Thanks, Wilton.
All right. So, on Proposition A, I declared that there seemed to be consensus that law enforcement agencies, public law enforcement agencies, can be recognized categorically as a party with a legitimate need for access. Now, based on Aubrey's comments on the list, we're not saying anything necessarily about how they get that access, what kind of certification or procedure they go through, but in principle, we're simply saying that nobody here can conceive of a situation in which law enforcement agencies would never be granted access to the shielded OPOC shielded data, and that they all can conceive of situations in which there would be a legitimate claim, and it's just a question of defining those procedures. So does anybody disagree with that?
Can I ask a question of definition, Milton?
Sure.
When you're referring, this is going to sound pedantic, but I think it's an important question to ask. When you're referring to law enforcement agencies, you're referring to those agencies with a legislative mandate. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm talking about governmental agencies that are empowered to enforce the law, to police the law.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no disagreement on that proposition, A, that I'm hearing. Is that correct? Going once? All right, so that was easy, as I expected. Now, I made another statement, and this is a more controversial statement, as it should be, but it's also what logically precarious in the sense that it's proving a negative. But I found great diversity and not much movement discernible on the issue of private party access. And I proposed more of an operational thing. Maybe that kind of a proposition doesn't belong in the report, but since we do have about 2 weeks left, I thought it might be constructive to concentrate our time on LEAs. But let's remove that from consideration for the moment and talk about private party access. Does anybody believe that there's some kind of a solution or approach that's been discussed or could be discussed that would achieve widespread agreement in this group?
Philip, Milton, just a clarifying question. Are you saying that you believe that's the case both for query-based and bulk access and the case of a specific domain request? That there was, even for that latter smaller case, there was a chorus of voices saying no, never.
I think you're identifying a good point, which is that the proposition D, the last one, about the type of might be logically prior to the proposition B. That is, if there was widespread agreement that private party access would be limited to type 1, that is, access limited to the records of a particular domain or registrant suspected of causing problems at a specific time, that it might be possible for this group to reach agreement. So, Philip, do you think we should consider Proposition D now?
Well, yeah, I mean, just in terms of, for me, as I say, we're listing options here and just making some comments about them. So I said it's always easier to do the easier wins first, and if that's going to be one of them, then let's give it a go.
Okay.
This is Walt from OPSA. Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Okay, from what I know from the practice of private parties that are active in the anti-spam business, so to say, is that they sometimes litigate privately against spammers. And to be able to do that, they will need some sort of access to the data. The question is whether that has great haste or it's something which is investigated over time. And I think in the case of banks with phishing, then there probably is a high-speed need for banks to close a phishing site as fast as possible. But that's usually one data records, and do the banks need to find that data themselves, or do they have a good relationship with law enforcement that are able to do that for them? And when they want to privately litigate a person, they can get that sort of information through the usual ways in which you get this sort of information, I think. Is that something which will make the discussion easier also?
I think it's a good point. In my mind, it raises the question of whether we should add a type 4 access in which private parties obtain the information via the intermediation of law enforcement. And I'm not sure whether this idea makes any sense, but if that's an option, it seems to me to be a distinctive type of access in which they don't have direct access to the shielded WHOIS data. They simply get it from law enforcement.
Milton, can you add Carol to the queue on that particular point, please?
Carol, there is no queue, so you have the floor if you want.
Thank you. Just a quick point of observation here. I think that for certain, can't make the global statement that police or law enforcement agencies are allowed to give access to data in a database which is not their own. That is to say that if police have access to a database, it doesn't automatically allow police to give that information to somebody else, even if the party providing access to the database, so let's say ICANN, is allowing us to distribute the information. I'm not 100% convinced that we would actually have a lawful authority to provide that information to somebody else. Now, having said that, I'm more than happy, Milton, to ask our access to information personnel if that is, in fact, an issue.
This is Walt from OPTA. I can comment to that directly. We are, by law, not even allowed to give this sort of information to a private party. And that will probably be so for the whole EU, but I'm not sure of that. But I know it's a big discussion with spam databases around Europe.
This is John Levine. Can I get the line?
Go ahead, John.
I actually was talking to John Crayett, who does exactly this. He's a lawyer who works closely with law enforcement in anti-spam cases. And he tells me it works exactly the opposite from the way you're suggesting. The individual party does the research, and then it basically provides to law enforcement the details it needs to recollect this stuff in a way that it can use in a court case. And so, you know, for this to work, you have to flip it around and say that law enforcement could deputize people who they knew were working legitimately on cases or something like that.
That's exactly what's being suggested, John. This Type 4 access, should we decide to stick it in there, is not a description of how things are now. It's a description of an option.
But I'm saying that the person doing the research would be the third party, not law enforcement.
Well, again, the who is information is out there. A lot of it, you have a name, you have a state, you have a country. What we're talking about is getting the additional step of the street address and the other contact information. And the question is whether we want to define as an option having the private party go to law enforcement for that, which introduces some kind of filtering mechanism that might add legitimacy. But, as the law enforcement representative was pointing out, we make some obstacles to that in certain jurisdictions.
Yeah, Milton, I said it also. I just have another perhaps slightly naive question. I'm also wondering if it actually matters to us if that's the case or not. Supposing we end up with a conclusion, private parties only get access to the information via law enforcement, and we're giving law enforcement some sort of access. Well, then, so what? Law enforcement's going to make those decisions regardless of our view.
Yes, and then
I'm struggling a bit with believing that's actually relevant for our discussion. I mean, it's almost as saying, as far as we're concerned, no private access. If law enforcement uses to do something, if their regime allows them, so be it. But you know, that's outside of our box, isn't it?
Right. So you're saying it's not really a different type of access for the purposes of this working group.
I think so. I mean, I'm speculating just on a sort of a logical train of thought rather than anything more technically related to who is. Maybe others who have a more expert view on that, but it just struck me that seemed to be the.
I think it's a good analysis, Philip. Yeah.
Milton, this is Steve. Could I get in the queue?
Sure. Go ahead.
I assume we're now talking about the part of your paper, the degree of access granted part of your paper.
The degree of access granted.
And leading up to your proposition D.
Right.
I was a little confused about exactly which proposals fell in which categories. It seems to me that Type 1 describes a lot of the proposals that have been made because, but it's also, they also have elements of Type 2. So for example, if you say that, let's just take the bank one, for example. If you say that if you adopted Palmer's proposal, then the bank would have query-based access to any domain, but limited in time, but it would also, its access would be limited to the records of the particular domains or registrants suspected of causing problems at a specific time. They would not have the authority under their certificate or whatever, you know, under their terms of access to just access somebody's who is data that was not suspected of being involved in a problem at a specific time. So I'm not sure whether a number one, whether number one is really directed to a proposal, if we have any in front of us, in which you have to get permission or you have to walk through the gateway each time and get your use approved, or whether I'm supposed to take it literally and say you have access to any domain that is suspected of causing problems at a specific time.
Milton, this is Dan. Could I comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's a good point. I think basically there are two different things going on here. One is the pre-screening step. Does the bank have to give a reason to access a particular domain? And then there's the questions of mechanics. How does that happen, and is there enforcement of violation or something like that? But it seems to me that number two would imply that you don't have to have any specific reason to access protected data from a domain. So you would just be able to get access to any domain for any reason.
That was my impression of, for example, the ESA proposal and I think David Ferris's proposal was that you basically had a subscription to the WHOIS database, period. And once you were certified, once you got that subscription through some kind of a filing of an application and an affidavit, then you had the full run of the WHOIS database. And type one access envisages that the private party is saying the following domains are causing trouble. We want to know who's behind them.
Milton, if I may on this subject.
May?
Thank you. Not commenting on any of the specific types that you've laid out here, but the first sentence that you've, under degrees of access granted, you use the word can be granted. I think there's three or four degrees of access that we've theorized would be useful to grant, but I question whether or not we can actually implement some of these types, so we might want to be a little bit softer with our language here. For instance, there is no mechanism right now to time limit query-based access, not without replacing the entire WHOIS system itself.
Right.
So it's theoretically useful. whether it's practically administratively possible is another story.
You're absolutely right. We have kind of deferred the practical and cost discussion because we cannot confront those adequately until we know sort of what we want to do. But we may indeed discover that the kind of access we want to grant is either too costly or not technically possible. I guess you might say that anything is possible if you're willing to spend enough money on it, but yes, we might indeed find that. That's a good warning to issue, Ron. So again, the proposition is if we can limit access to the records of particular domains and registrants suspected of causing problems, is that something everybody could agree that we should allow private parties to do?
Say that again, Milton. I'm sorry.
If we can limit access to WHOIS, the shielded WHOIS elements, to particular domains and or registrants suspected of causing problems at a particular time, is that something that everybody can agree private parties should be able to do?
This is Walter. Also, but how do you determine who is giving trouble or is suspected of foul play?
That is that's a practical question, and we are in the theoretical realm.
Okay.
Really, I was going to ask the same question.
But again, it's the type of access we're concerned about. If we don't ever want to give private parties access, then somebody should speak up. If, you know, somebody who believes that should speak up. So nobody objects, if it's possible, nobody objects to giving private parties access to particular domains and so on, causing trouble.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand the question correctly, Milton, but there's way too many qualifications in front of that statement for me to be able to agree with it. In other words, is it any private party? How are those private parties qualified? What are the acts? Like, there's just way too many questions there for me to say, yeah, that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, yes.
At least with law enforcement, the need is extremely clear. The stakeholder group is very, very clear. And there's been several discussions around technology and application that at least lead us to some faint glimmer of hope that the theoretical is practical. And I just don't see it with this second set of questions.
Milton, this is Steve. Could I get in the queue?
Go ahead.
I think if I understand what you're covering by type one, there really are two different ways this could happen. It really boils down to who decides whether a query that's made is limited to the record of particular domains suspected of causing problems. There are two ways you could do that. One is to say that every time, whatever the qualified private party is, and leaving that aside, whenever they want access to a record, they have to go to some gatekeeper and say, well, I want this, and here's why, and the gatekeeper says yes or no. The other way is that they get some more general access under a contract or a license that says you can only use it for these purposes. You can only make a query when you suspect a particular domain and/or registrant of causing problems at a specific time, and that's the limit of your access. And then the question is, what's the mechanism for enforcing that? But I think those could both fit into the definition of number one as it stands now, but I think most people would probably view those as rather different models. I'm just suggesting maybe to unpack that.
I agree that is a distinction that needs to be made, and I want to try to write that down.
Milton, this is David. If I could just clarify, mine was meant to be, my proposal was meant to include the latter.
Mike Warnicki, can I get in the queue, please?
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm sorry, I dropped out of the call a few moments ago, so I apologize. I just wanted a clarification on the Type 2 access. Our proposal, the ESA proposal, I think it's too broad to say it's unlimited access to all who is records. I mean, we are limiting it to the third parties for specific purposes, so I think that just needs to be clarified there. I don't feel comfortable with necessarily that characterization of our proposal.
Okay, but basically you agree that if you had this access, you could make a request of any domain in the DNS.
Well, to the extent it falls within the categories of purposes that are covered by our proposal, yes.
So that would mean that if you consider a, you know, just a complete data mining automated process of searching and scouring the entire whois a necessary part of doing your trademark protection activity, then that would be legitimate under your view, right?
Well, no. I mean, that's not one of the purposes we identified, and moreover, that's not the way we go about using the whois information. For first there's a site that's problematic, and then we query the whois database. We're not querying the whois database at random, looking for things.
But you would be able to with the kind of unlimited access that we're talking about under Type 2.
Well, not under ESA's proposal. I mean, and there would be the enforcement mechanism as well. But I realize you may not want to go into all that right now. But I think it's important to clarify that you know, it's not a, a rubber stamp, go get them, you know, do whatever you want kind of proposal.
Hilton, this is Dan again.
Yeah.
Can I comment? It seems to me that a lot of the people that might have been suspected of being in favor of type 2 access are disavowing themselves of that, and perhaps the difference between type 1 and type 2 is really the breakout that had just been previously suggested for type 1, which is really what the mechanics are. Is there a mechanical pre-screening process, or is there only post-facto enforcement?
Right. I think, and that's pretty much what I meant by type 1 and type 2. Although I put too much emphasis on limited in time, and I should have been more specific. So I think we can clarify that. But the problem with type 2, or not necessarily a problem, you may or may not consider it a problem, is that once that level of access is granted, it is the user of the WHOIS database who decides, without any review, who is a suspect and who is not. And that could include, quite literally, anybody for any reason. And the burden of proof has been shifted to somebody to prove that this is used for purposes, you know, that are wider than their claim to be. So I think that by granting type 2 access, you really are pretty much giving query-based access to any domain. We don't want to get to the enforcement mechanism. We want to really just talk about access now. But I think that there's a big, big difference between those two. And it really has to do with where the burdens lie. We all know that that's, you know, what all these policy debates generally revolve around, is who ends up suffering the burdens and bearing the costs of different kinds of policies. So for example, in my own case, taking my chairman's hat off and talking as a constituency member and working group member, I think I could live with type 1 access granted to private parties while recognizing that the costs of implementing that are something that need to be looked at carefully.
Actually, Milton, I'm sorry, if there's a queue on, I don't mean to jump it.
I don't think there is a queue, so go ahead.
I'm going to re-raise the theory versus practice thing again. My understanding of the work that we're intended to do here is to build consensus around the areas where we can build consensus in terms of making the operational point of contact proposal more acceptable to a broader range of stakeholders. I'll bring up my previous concern again in a slightly different way by noting that that proposal is, its lowest common denominator is port 43 access. Until we hear a competent and concrete proposal that is no longer an acceptable means of conducting our WHOIS service, I think we need to bound our discussion within the scope of the capabilities of that existing protocol and service. I don't see any other way around it. I hate to say that this is a theoretical issue. Let's keep talking about it until we can prove that we can't do it. The Port 43 protocol is a very, very specific tool that can do very, very specific things. So for us to go down the road any further of type 1 or type 2 access, it's just not, the protocol will not permit that behavior.
Milton, this is Steve. Could I ask Ross a question here?
Go ahead.
Wouldn't that also be true of law enforcement access? I mean, my question is, how is law enforcement access differ from other third-party access in terms of port 43?
Well, the difference is that the law enforcement community is well-bounded. It's identifiable. And there's at least one proposal that I'm aware of that allows the port 43 service to be used to serve slightly different data to the law enforcement community using encryption. To the extent that private parties can be somehow qualified and accredited in the same way that law enforcement agencies can, then it can be used for those means. But I think we need to be explicit that that's the path we're going down.
Okay, so it's not it's not as much a technical problem as a problem of is it practical to accredit and identify and bound, if you will, the entities that have that access.
What I'm commenting on, Steve, is that limiting access to the records of a particular domain or registrants, et cetera, type 1 access, is not possible using port 43. Query-based access for a limited period of time is not possible using port 43.
Milton, can I get in the queue? This is Margie.
It's not possible to unless people are limited to somehow making their queries from a single IP address, which I don't think anybody's proposing. There's no way to separate the wheat from the chaff to the degree that type of differentiated access would require.
Okay, Margie.
Put it for the queue as well, please.
Sure. I disagree with Ross. What's happening right now with the registrars is there is limitations on access on port 43, and it's done exactly as Ross indicated. It's IP address based. So theoretically, we could have a whitelist of those with rate limits on, you know, depending upon the type of organization. And that is already done by the registrars today. So there are limitations.
Is that your legal opinion, Margie, or a technical one?
Oh, it's a technical one because we deal with it every day as a registrar. And in fact, ICANN has established a whitelist for registrars in order to do queries for registrar-related business. And so that concept is already in place.
Okay, so when you actually figure out a way to keep Jay Westerdahl from scraping your whois and reselling it, let me know.
somebody else said they wanted to get on the queue, but I didn't.
That was Philip. Thanks, Milton. Just a question perhaps for the registrars, both of you. I mean, are you saying that despite our interesting discussion about 1, 2, 3 or even more type degrees of access granted, that in effect today the only practical way is port 43 access, albeit with limitation possibilities, and that therefore in terms of pragmatic implementation we should only focus on thinking about that type of access and then decide who gets it?
That's a question for Ron.
I think what I'm saying there, Philip, is that port 43 is the lowest common denominator of access to the WHOIS data. It's a protocol with 20 years of history, and it's not something that can be easily thrown away. But to the extent that we're making propositions related to WHOIS services, it needs to be consistent with the realities of that protocol. Certainly the operational point of contact proposal was tabled within that light. Our work is bounded by that council document at this point, so I think it's only a natural extension that we take that into account.
I have a question, Margie, for you, and if Jay Westerdahl is on, he might be interested in asking it. I know we've had some exchanges about this before, but suppose that you were, you know, I know that you are a service provider. You do extensive analysis of the WHOIS database for anti-fraud clients and so on. Suppose that you only had what the OPAS proposal publishes to work with. Wouldn't there an extensive amount of analysis still be possible in terms of the you know, analyzing patterns of the OPOC listed, the name, the jurisdiction listed, the domain name, IP address, and name servers, and so on. So could you still, how much would your work be hampered if you only had what the OPOC publishes, what the OPOC recommendation publishes to work with?
I'm sure. If the OPOC becomes a proxy service, so in other words, if the OPOC's information is not really the registrant's information, that's where the analysis, where it's difficult to have the kind of analysis that we currently have.
So you still have a name and the jurisdictional information, and the OPOC itself is, you know, presumably something that would have to be invented or something by a fraudulent person. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So for example, just say for the sake of argument that the OPOC is a fraudster puts in a registrar's information or some sort of proxy type information. the information that's missing in the, under the current OPOC proposal is we wouldn't have access to the address and the email address of the registrant, and that's very key in the analysis that we do for fraud-related purposes. Because if it's, you know, I sent an email out to this effect, but if there's a domain name registered, say Bank of America Online or something, and you look at the and if you can look at the email address for the registrant, if it doesn't say, you know, some address at bankofamerica.com and instead says, you know, margie@aol.com, that's a red flag where we can identify that that's probably a fraudulent site and gives, you know, the information we need to dig further.
But wouldn't, you know, for example, couldn't you go to the legitimate Bank of America site, see who the OPOC was, and compare that, or look at the country and state information and see that that's not a name that's anyway associated with Bank of America?
Yes, you could. You could certainly look at the OPOC information, but the reason why the registrant information is useful is because I believe that's the information that the registrar would use to provide information to that registrant. And so, I just don't know if we'll have complete, you know, information to be able to make that leap. And fraudsters would, you know, they theoretically could mimic the information of the bank in the OPOC information.
Right.
Milton, this is Dan.
Dan, go ahead.
It might be useful for us to consider the difference between direct access and indirect access, because access in the general sense is a wider policy matter than potential access through port 43. It seems to me that's what type 1 might be about, is the indirect kind of access.
I'm sorry, there was some noise in the middle of your talk. What could you...
I was suggesting that we distinguish indirect access from direct access, with direct access being port 43 and indirect access being some kind of tiered access or pre-screened path along or something like that.
Okay. That's.
It seems to me that that's kind of what we're aiming for with type 1 access.
And indirect means a technical process or a legal social process?
A legal social process, but probably if it's going to be implemented on a timely basis, there would have to be a separate technical process constructed to assist that.
Okay. So I think Margie made an important point that we are, in fact, limiting port 43 access.
Milton, it's a false. It's a completely bad bit of technical advice from Martin Castellano. I'd be happy to walk you through why, but it's not possible today to actually authenticate anyone using port 43. And given the degree to which IP addresses can be spoofed, the mechanism that she suggests is completely full of holes.
This is Steve. Could I get in the queue?
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand how port 43 impacts on this. My understanding is, let's assume the OPOC proposal is adopted, then via port 43, anybody coming in via port 43 would have access to the data that's public. It would be the name, province and country, and the OPOC data. That's all through port 43. Then the other data that's collected, the other data about the registrant and presumably still the admin and tech contact data, unless that's changed, that would be somewhere else. And we're talking about who has access to that data and under what circumstances and how. But there's no presumption that they would be gaining access to that data via port 43, is there? My understanding is that it wouldn't necessarily be through port 43. But the question is, who has access and under what conditions?
I think it's a fair question, Steve. It's certainly been my assumption that it would happen via port 43, but it's a fair question.
So as opposed to port 43, it might be you send a message to the registrar or the OPOC, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways it could happen. It could be web-based access. It could be through an email exchange. I mean, it really gets to the question, the distinction I was trying to draw between type 1 and 2 or 1A and 1B, which is there a gatekeeper who says, each time, yes, you can have access, no, you can't have access, or do certain entities get more or less a subscription or some kind of access for certain purposes? But either way, I don't assume that it would be through port 43.
Well, that complicates things even more, doesn't it? I guess this email or FOPOC falls under the category of what Dan was calling indirect access, if we want to call port 43 direct access. But I think I agree with Ross that the established mechanism for providing who is now is indeed port 43, and that's the kind of rapid query-based access that most people are interested in actually having. And the other kinds of access raise barriers that don't exist in port 43. Let me try to wrap up this discussion.
You mean for now, right?
For now. We're going to have to reformulate our access options, obviously. But in the most general principle terms, then, what I'm hearing is that we cannot come up with a complete support for the idea that access to private parties could be granted, even if it is limited to particular domains and registrants. And some of that lack of support stems from questions about the technical viability, and some of it stems from not enough knowledge about who is going to be granted this kind of access. Is that correct?
It certainly summarizes from my perspective, Milton.
Now, I would like to make some progress on the bank proposal, if we could. Is there anybody who opposes, other than me? I think I've made my opinion clear, and that it has nothing to do with the merits of the bank proposal per se, but with the idea of tackling the problem on a sectoral basis. But is there anybody else who does not want to try to solve the problem at least for one sector? That is, if you could make a case that we're not going to agree on much, but we've taken law enforcement and agreed to do something about them. Should we also try to do something about banks, or does anybody oppose that other than me?
Milton, this is Dan.
Yes.
I still am not quite sure why, if we can come up with an effective solution for banks, it couldn't be extended to other sectors generally. Unless there's something really specific about the bank regulation paradigm for law enforcement that can't be extended. But I still have questions about that, so I probably would oppose it for that reason.
Milton Philip here, just perhaps as a workaround, I mean, I think what may be useful, rather than promulgating banks as an option to go forward, but just using banks for now as a possible private sector model, given that there are some characteristics in terms of the regulatory regime surrounding banks that might make it easier, and that therefore that model could then be looked at its robustness for other groups. I think that might have merit and might solve the concern you have, which I share, in that I don't think it's ultimately useful to have a sectoral approach. But if we can pursue an approach as a paradigm, that may be useful.
Philip, this is David Ferris. Can I just chime in on that?
If you could put me in the queue as well, please, Milton.
Okay, David, and then Ron.
I think that's interesting if we consider this as an example, but I wouldn't want it to be qualified in such a way that banks have been highlighted because they are regulated. Those of us that are not in regulated sectors still have legitimate needs for access to who is. So I would just wouldn't want that caveat included in it, if this is going to serve as an example.
Okay, Ross?
I was only going to make the point that it may be that the banking industry shares more similarities with law enforcement. It may be useful to frame up the question in terms of to the extent that those similarities exist. It may be interesting/useful to open up that question at a future date.
And secondarily, to the extent that there are other sectors that share those same characteristics, we may wish to implement some sort of a once we've proved ourselves with the law enforcement access, it may be useful in opening up to other sectors. So I don't necessarily share the position that the sectoral approach isn't the way to go, but I believe that our first step with this is the law enforcement sector.
Ross, I can't make a lot of sense out of your position in terms of preparing a report. Can you tell me, when you talk about deferring...
The question for me right now is whether or not we can get access right for law enforcement, because it's a clear, distinct group. To the extent that there are other clear, distinct groups, we may wish, from a policy or from a procedural basis, to roll this type of access out to those groups in the future. In other words, I would prefer not to carve something out specific for banks right now until we actually understand what's going on with this first kick at the can. Does that make more sense?
Yes, it does. So that is basically a very soft no.
I just don't know enough about banks at this point. No, I'm still trying to wrap my head around law enforcement, so it can't get much more
The key point
than that.
You think that law enforcement should serve as a model for banks, possibly, in the future. And Philip is saying that banks might serve as a model for other private sector actors. So Philip's position is, again, somewhat ambiguous in terms of how I drafts it up and its operational implications. And as far as I can tell, David Ferris's concern is only that he doesn't want private sector to be categorized on the basis of regulated industries get some privileges and others don't. So, David, what are you saying about going forward with a bank sector-specific proposal for banks?
As I understood Philip's suggestion, it was that we would use the bank right now as an example, but we would not determine whether or not it would be a sector-specific or a generic approach for private actors. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think without making any value judgment, I mean, my interest would be assessing its practicality. And once you've done that, that should help us assess the practicality for other groups.
Mrs. Wild, off track, can I get in the queue?
I wish you would, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want me to finish first, Milton? I'm not sure.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry if you were not finished.
Yeah, so with that in mind, I just don't want there to be a distinction that would be carried forward between regulated and unregulated, given that that is simply an example. That was my point.
Okay, so you're basically agreeing with Philip, but you just don't want that distinction to be based in any way on regulated versus unregulated.
I would say if we proceed in the way Philip suggested, that's my point.
And so to clarify my point, Milton, I'm agreeing with Philip, but I'm saying that banks are the wrong place to start.
Maybe right.
Philip, this is Susan Calzucci. Can I get in the queue?
Yes, Wild, and then Susan.
Okay, thank you. What I think from my perspective is that it should be clear why private parties want access and what do they need access for, and only then you can determine whether they have to have generic access or whether individual access per case is sufficient and how much of the whole database they need to see. And I think only then, if you identify that per private actor, I think you can proceed and to see in which way they need access. And by granting them generic access, you probably will give away too much from a privacy point of view. That's my point. And I'm sorry that I have to dial off now because I've got another meeting. If there are any questions, please send me an email and I'll be glad to answer them. So bye-bye for me.
Thank you very much. Well, that wild statement I would take as a statement of support for the idea that if we're going to give private parties access, it's going to be what we've been calling type 1 access. Of course, that position has been complicated by our discussion of the type 1, by the complications of actually delivering that kind of access. All right, so Susan.
I just don't think we should focus just on the banks. I think there's a lot of legitimate users out there and a lot of categories we could establish, and we should look at all legitimate users and then define their access instead of just focusing on banks and maybe down the line focus on other groups. So I would be very hesitant to agree to anything where we haven't evaluated every legitimate group for access.
This is Melissa Martino. I agree with that because one other legitimate task to ask in the first organization is around sourcing data sets and bank issues. Clearly, the conference identified a number of other legitimate stakeholders that need access.
Am I the only one that
I couldn't understand that.
That was a very static-filled intervention. I could not even tell who it was.
Milton, can I just ask a quick question? How much longer are we going to go? I have a 10:30 meeting.
2 minutes. I do, too. So I think I have a pretty good sense of how we fall out on the bank. Is there anybody with a completely different position on the bank issue? All right, so I will revise the report based on this discussion. It's been, a very useful one, and the report will be much more precise next time. And next week, obviously, the discussion will focus on access mechanisms. And thank you very much for participating.
Thanks, Wilson. Thanks, Tom.